There are many areas of life where the same rules apply to everyone, and personal finance is certainly one area where each person should develop their own financial roadmap. With us to discuss this is Edgar Norton, director of ISU's Institute for Financial Planning and Analysis. Let's start with savings, Edgar. There are some basic rules in place for this, but how do you know if you should keep them close at heart or maybe do what's right for you if you have the strong feeling that way?
Yes, Willis, there's one of the rules of thumb out there is that you should try to have a cash emergency fund of 3 to 6 months worth of living expenses in case you need 4 new tires on your car. You can whip out your plastic, get the 4 new tires, and when the credit card bill comes next month, you just move that money from savings to checking and bingo, the bill is paid. And you're not paying the credit card company any interest.
But doesn't that differ according to your income and your wealth and things like that?
Yep. It basically comes back to what happens if I can't work. I lose my job or I'm injured and I can't work. Many disability income policies don't pay out until you've been out of work for 6 months. And so, okay, the rule developed that you should have 3 to 6 months of savings. If you're single, you definitely need perhaps 6 months. If you're married, maybe a little bit less because if there's a second income in the family. But indeed, as you point out, it does depend. A single person might need a bigger cushion than a married person, especially if the spouse is working and receiving an income. If I'm getting a straight salary versus a commission. Commissions are a whole lot variable. I can get into a rough patch there and not get much commission income. And so I might need a bigger cushion. If my income is commission-based as opposed to a salary situation.
So while the amounts may differ, the rule that you should have some sort of savings nest egg built up for emergencies is still something you should do.
It's still a good idea. You never know what might happen to you health-wise, so you want to have that cash buffer to help you get over that illness or sickness when you can't work and you don't have a paycheck coming in, as well as the fact that, yeah, surprises happen. You need the new roof. You need a new engine in your car or the 4 new tires, and why pay interest if you can keep that money in savings and pay that bill in full when the bill comes due.
Planning for that retirement nest egg is something that we have talked about many times on Sound Money in the past. There are some certain rules out there that people say you should follow. Are those myths or are they actually good ideas?
Well, in some ways, there's some discussion going on in the financial planning community about some of these issues. For example, one basic rule is that you should, whatever your retirement nest egg is, you should try to live on 4% of that. So your first year of retirement, take out 4% of that nest egg, and then increase that dollar amount, not the percentage, but increase the dollar amount by the inflation rate all throughout your retirement. So in other words, your real spending stays the same as you make these withdrawals from your account. That's a very well-known study in financial planning called the 4% rule, and it was done about 25, 30 years ago when, as you might recall, interest rates were different than they were today, and the stock market was lower than it is today. And we had also much better average stock market returns back then than we have had, say, in the past decade. And so some people are saying that 4% rule might turn into maybe a 3% rule in today's environment. But other financial planners are saying, you know, the pension is going the way of the dodo bird. Many people have 401ks or 403bs where it's on your head to invest the money rather than the employer to provide you a paycheck in retirement. And so some people are saying you should try to grow your retirement account and then annuitize some of that. Take a chunk of that money and buy an annuity, which is kind of make it into a quasi-pension. And so rather than spending 4% a year, you just give them maybe half, three quarters, whatever might be appropriate for your situation. Give that money to an insurance company, and they will give you a paycheck for the rest of your life. People have been working all their life for a paycheck, and they like that mindset. And so getting an annuity might be one way of keeping you happy in retirement.
Even the American dream of owning your own home is not for everyone. Is it a myth that the ultimate goal of your own personal financial situation should be to own a home?
Again, I'm a good economist here in some ways. It depends. And you have one hand, and on the other hand, you have these situations. If you're pretty sure you're going to be setting down roots in a community, you get a job at Illinois State or State Farm or Country or any other hospital here in town, and you believe you're going to be here, you like the community, you might as well buy the home and start building up equity. It's a forced savings program. Buying a home is forced savings because every month you're writing that mortgage check And slowly over time, you're building up equity in your home. And someday, you sell that home and you have some cash to use either to supplement your retirement or maybe to roll over into another home. But obviously, if you're unsure about how long you might be in a location, or you're concerned about your own financial situation, you know, renting does give you more flexibility. But even then, there's a caveat. Depending upon the state of the economy, it might be more expensive to rent than to buy. You know, go back a few years to our Great Recession, 2008, 2009, it was actually cheaper in some places to buy a home than to rent. Rents were higher than the mortgage payment.
But it was oftentimes harder to get a mortgage because the rules had changed, so, and banks were not as willing to.
Indeed, they're checking out your credit history really careful there. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, I hate to sound wishy-washy and fuzzy here, but I'm going to be wishy-washy and fuzzy, and it depends on situations. It's not a slam dunk. You're right. Because, yeah, once you buy a house, those homeowners out there, you know you never really own your home. Even if you paid off your mortgage and you think you own your home 100%, you're still paying rent every year in the form of property taxes. You get your police, fire, and water, and other protection there. And so, but you're still paying rent on it. You're still paying out that. And, of course, expenses happen, the furnace, the roof, the air conditioner, just regular maintenance on the home. And so when you're renting, all that is someone else's problem. But, of course, when it's your house, it's on your head.
What about having a personal financial advisor? Is it best to have one person to channel all the areas that you put your money, for instance, college savings or health savings, or maybe you're saving to buy a house or maybe buy a car or something like that? Or is it better to have many minds contribute to your thinking and help guide you through what you should do with your money? So is it better to have one person or several people guide you financially?
Well, if you have $1 billion like Warren Buffett, it's probably good to have a couple of advisors because your case is so complicated. But for most of the rest of us, and good people might disagree on this, but my bias would be to have one person, but one very knowledgeable person. In fact, maybe one person at a firm, and that firm has a tax expert for my tax issues, and they have someone who knows insurance who can help find me an appropriate insurance policy for my needs, as well as someone who's very knowledgeable about investments and can help me structure my college savings plan or my retirement plan to get ready for retirement. And so it's hard for one person to be a jack of all trades, but if that one person has a team behind them, they can consult with the team members. You know, I want to draw up a will or make sure I have a good estate plan. That person can draw upon the expertise of a lawyer or a tax attorney if I'm in a complicated tax situation. And so the issue with having, you know, a tax person here, an insurance person in another company, an investment person with another firm is they may not talk to each other. They're looking at you as a silo, whereas an overall financial planner can look at the entire person and know how your taxes might affect your retirement and the estate plan and the insurance issues you're facing and all that. So I kind of like the one-stop-shop approach.
Edgar Norton is director of ISU's Institute for Financial Planning and Analysis. We've been talking about some of the myths of personal finance. Edgar, as always, thank you.
My pleasure, Willis.
I'm Willis Kern.